Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, well, actually, I'm in Boulder. This is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar.
What's this?
That's the Perfect Attendance Award and the Punctuality Award. I got those at Rushmore. I thought you could choose which one you liked more, and you could wear that one, and I could wear the other.
I'll take punctuality.
That's Bill Murray and Jason Schwartzman and Cat Stevens in Wes Anderson's Rushmore.
So, Adam, since I am recording this show from Boulder, Colorado, does that make me ineligible for the attendance award?
You are absolutely ineligible, but you did dial in on time, so the punctuality pin is all yours, Josh.
Yes.
You are in Boulder, Colorado this week as host of this year's Ebert Interruptus, where you were leading a screening of Anderson's 1998 film, and that was reason enough for us to give Rushmore the old sacred cow treatment.
We've got that discussion, plus your 2017 Film Spotting Madness champion, and Adam's conversation with the director of the new documentary, American Anarchist. It's all ahead on Film Spotting. Making time.
Josh, in fact, in Boulder, Colorado, I hear it's lovely there. Do you agree?
It is gorgeous, although at the moment I am in the bowels of the University of Colorado Boulder's theater building. So it's not too picturesque right now, but it's a great space for recording the show, I hope. There was some drumming and shouting going on somewhere a little bit earlier. That seems to have calmed down, so I think this will work well. I want to thank Michael J. Casey of the Boulder Weekly, who helped put together the Ebert Interruptus event. He found this space for me, so we should be good here.
Well, more on that here in a little bit, but you're saying no mountains there in the basement with you. I thought there were mountains everywhere in Colorado.
No window, can't see them.
Wow. Well, we will have more talk about Josh's Colorado trip here in a moment and a lot more Film Spotting Madness talk later in the show. We will reveal this year's Film Spotting Madness champion. Josh, I'm not sure what we're going to do to fill time on this show without madness.
No kidding. The dirty little secret is that it was a nice time filler, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. We also will have my interview with documentary director Charlie Siskel, whose new film, American Anarchist, is currently out in limited release. That film about Bill Powell, author of the notorious bomb-making manual, The Anarchist Cookbook.
But first, we revisit Rushmore. Does my favorite Wes Anderson film deserve sacred cow status? If not, Nihilo Sanctum Esne? Is nothing sacred?
You remember how I got into this school?
Yes. You wrote a play.
That's right. Second grade. A little one act about Watergate. And my mother read it and felt I should go to Rushmore. And you read it and you gave me a scholarship, didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Do you regret it?
No, I don't regret it. But I still might have to expel you.
Couldn't we just let me float by? For old time's sake?
Can't do it.
A great scene there between Jason Schwartzman and Brian Cox from Rushmore. And Josh, that bit, a very blatant reference to one of our Film Spotting Madness finalists, the Godfather, Tessio Abe Vigoda, talking to Robert Duvall. Did anyone yell that out during your Ebert Interruptus?
Oh, there were some Godfather moments that were pointed out. Also, we noticed right away the scene between Max and Bloom's wife is very conversation-esque, as well as All the President's Men and even North by Northwest. So yes, the references piled up quickly during Interruptus.
Yeah, I swear I saw at least one graduate reference, maybe two, because there's a pool sequence and the scene on the overpass when we see Max running. So certainly plenty of cinematic homages in this film, as we have gotten from Anderson throughout his career. in the completely non-existent battle of the directing Andersons, I'm thinking here of P.T. and Wes, a duo who, for whatever it's worth, truly are cinematic contemporaries. They're born 1 year apart, with breakout films, Boogie Nights and Rushmore, coming out 1 year apart. I've always been in the P.T. bunker, while you've always been in the twee and meticulously decorated Wes foxhole. You see what I did
everything,
there?
Everything is in its place here, Adam.
Now, I'm foregoing the usual long-winded setup here because I'm dying to know how Ebert Interruptus went, and you may need to set that up again briefly for some of our listeners who aren't familiar with it. And specifically, I'm curious what new insights you glean from this unique viewing of the Anderson film you have ranked as your very favorite. Did your frame-by-frame dissection solidify the movie's position at the top of the class? Or, like the movie's passionate but misguided protagonist Max Fisher, is Rushmore due for a must-attend Grover Cleveland-like fall?
Yes, it turns out this is a terrible movie, Adam.
Oh, you finally saw the light. Overrated Wes Anderson.
No. I mean, really, once you get to take apart something, a movie as wonderful as this, your appreciation just grows. At least that's been my experience. And that's what we've been doing for listeners who don't remember the many, many years Roger Ebert led this session at the Conference on World Affairs. We watched the entire film on Monday, and today is Tuesday, so this afternoon, we got through about the first two-thirds of it, where anyone attending could just shout out stop, and we'd pause the DVD, and they would make a comment, ask a question, brief discussion, and then we'd move on. So it has been one of the most entertaining film viewing experiences that I've had, because the comments have been great so far. People have been mindful of others' time, so mm-hmm. We haven't really had anyone lording over the microphone. And just to see, this is something I knew, so it's not necessarily a new discovery, but to actually take the time to pause and notice every detail that comes into play, the surprise, surprise, meticulousness
yeah.
that is used by Anderson and his filmmaking team in terms of costuming, production mm-hmm. design, the use of music to generate so many laughs and so many continuous laughs that bleed into each other. And even things that he's, sometimes derided for, say a musical montage. And maybe the accusation is that it's easy to pick a great piece of music and plop it into your movie and you'll generate some energy and some emotion. And that's a cheat. Well, when you look at it this closely, you understand that specific songs are picked for specific reasons, mm-hmm. sometimes to provide that energy, sometimes to be ironic, and also they are almost always perfectly matched with the physical action on the screen. So I'm thinking of Bill Murray's Herman Bloom tossing golf balls into his pool at the very beginning, matching the loping rhythm of the Kinks' Nothing in the World Can Stop Me Worrying About That Girl. So mm-hmm. that sort of matching of sound and imagery, and in their rivalry sequence, which this one includes The Who's A Quick One While He's Away, it builds up to that moment where Murray's car brakes have been cut by Max, mm-hmm. and so he slowly comes to a stop, almost running over the groundskeeper, just as that lingering guitar chord of the song comes to a stop as well. There's a pause. Bloom gives the description of Max to the police.
5'3". 112 pounds, black hair, glasses, oval face.
And then the punchline comes with the final chord of that song and the ironic chorus of You Are Forgiven. So these are the sorts of things, you understand that's happening to you as you're watching the film, but when you do look at it almost frame by frame, the construction, again, no surprise, but sticks out, and you can really appreciate the intricacies at work here. Hmm.
All I want to know is, did you have to tell anyone? I hear what you're saying, but you're completely wrong.
So far, no. There was a little bit of suspicion. I thought we were going to be off to a really bad start, because at first someone did ask, this just doesn't seem realistic to me.
I
thought, oh boy, just wait. But I think they made it over that bump and got on board. It was interesting when we showed it yesterday. The vast majority, I'm saying probably 95% of the people who attended had not seen the film before.
Wow.
And yeah, that was a surprise to me. Also made me feel good because of, all the laughter that I heard during the screening meant it was still clicking with what was apparently a mostly new crowd.
There's a lot that you brought up already. Those widescreen frames are so full of detail, which we have come to expect from Anderson. So I'm not surprised that you guys lingered on those. And his use of music maybe is his greatest strength as a filmmaker. You mentioned that Who tune, that Kink song. These are not the most famous songs by these groups, and yet he picks out these deeper cuts and is able to employ them just perfectly. And of course, there is something fun about watching Max Fisher in that sequence, getting off the elevator with that Who song blaring in slow motion, takes his gum out, puts it on the wall for no reason whatsoever after the whole B sequence. And there are so many wonderful musical moments like that in this film. I will say one of the surprises for me watching this film, and it was the first time I had seen it since 1998, I believe, there was actually less music than I thought. And there's a lot of it, but I somehow expected that there would be more of those kind of musical montages. I remembered it that way, and I didn't feel like there were actually as many. It was a more kind of straightforward in some ways and more somber film than I recall.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. You know, and there's also the Mark Mothersbaugh score, of course, which is being used for different purposes, also for comedy, though. We were looking at one that had a heavy jazz drum beat to it when Max is having trees chopped down to have the aquarium put in where the baseball field is and how that tracking shot is. This is a musical comedy is one of the things I realized, in the sense that it doesn't have song and dance numbers, but so much of the laughs are coming in concert with the camera movement and with the imagery. And so though there is great dialogue and some wonderful one-liners, it's such a visually comic film and a musically comic film as well. So and the other thing I will say that stood out to me this time was how good Olivia Williams was.
And I agree.
This is, you know, it's in a way a role she doesn't get much active dialogue. She's often responding, and it's reaction shots for these two strange characters who have dropped into her life, and she doesn't know quite what to make of them. And watching that play on her face in various scenes, and even the way she negotiates her relationship with Max, it's really a delicate piece of acting that, you know, I always thought everyone in the cast was great from the first time I saw the film, but looking at it this time again, realized how important it was, the work that she was doing.
He thinks you dumped him because of Edward Appleby.
What does that mean?
Well, I mean you live in his room. With all his stuff, it's kind of...
I was married to him.
I know you were.
Although I will say that Edward has more spark and character and imagination in one fingernail than Herman Bloom has in his entire body.
One dead fingernail.
Right. One dead fingernail.
Yeah, I had a similar reaction. I think it is largely a thankless role. She has to be a little bit of a drip, thwarting our hero in his quest here. And she's a very serious person. Some of the more poignant scenes do involve her, but she grounds it. You talk about reality. I think she grounds the film and its ridiculousness with her frankness and her directness, not only in what she says to Max, but in the way she says it. So I think her performance is really good. For me, watching this film the second time, I went back and looked at my ranking on Letterboxd of Wes Anderson's films. And at the time I did it, I think it was right before the Grand Budapest Hotel came out. It was like 4 years ago. And I was going off the fact that I had seen all of these films only once. I didn't feel at all qualified to really rank them. But I put The Royal Tenenbaums first. I put Rushmore second. And I put Moonrise Kingdom third. And I know we have a little bit of a different ranking there, not only at the top of the list, but throughout the entire list of Anderson films. But I remember asking myself, do I really believe firmly that The Royal Tenenbaums is his best film? I also wondered, do I really like Rushmore more than Moonrise Kingdom? And after seeing Rushmore again, I know for a fact that I think The Royal Tenenbaums is his best film. And it's really not even close for me. And I'm giving even more credence to that thought that maybe if I rewatch Moonrise Kingdom, that could slide up to number two. So I suppose.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, I'm going to come off as the curmudgeon. I'm going to be the Sam here, our producer, former co-host, who played the role of Grump a little bit in our Royal Tenenbaum Sacred Cow review from last summer, where he was part of that three-man show. It's going to sound like I dislike this movie more than I did, because I really like the movie, and it is still in second place in my Wes Anderson ranking. But I just don't have the feelings for it, you, and I know Sam, and so many other people do. That love where you love it with the type of zest Max displays when he's talking about Rushmore or when he has an idea for a new club. I'm a little bit more like Herman when he's amused by Max's antics. And there are, though, so many wonderful moments and scenes, moments of pathos, moments of comedy. I'm sure we'll touch on some of them in detail. But for whatever reason, and I'm truly curious because I'm not sure I have pinpointed what it is, they just don't strike me with the same frequency or fervor as Tenenbaums. Now, I wonder, of course, if I saw it with a crowd like you did, if that would help maybe bring some of that comedy through. But I'd even say, as great as the musical choices are and as great as some of the framing is and some of the camera movement is, it's very much a Wes Anderson film stylistically. It's visually not as compelling for me as Tenenbaums is either. And I'm thinking of the use of music and the use of montage as well in that. But as I compare them, Josh, I do it only because Tenenbaums, of course, is the last Anderson movie I watched and loved. But I also know a lot of people regard them as his two best films. And so I was going to dismiss it. And then the more I thought about it, I realized how much crossover there really is. That house at 111 Archer Avenue in Tenenbaums is like Rushmore Academy. You could even argue that Etheline is sort of the headmistress of these self-contained universes. And Royal and Max are both these selfish, callous bastards who devour life, and they play by their own rules, and they expect everyone and everything to bend to their wants and desires. Oh, and they deeply love one thing more than themselves. In Max's case, it's first school, and then later the Olivia Williams character. And in Royal's case, played by Gene Hackman, of course, it's his family, but they channel that love in ways that are hurtful to those things and those people. And almost everyone that surrounds them, they are two characters who are redeemed ultimately and who grow without really sacrificing what defines them. And I guess just as much as I love Schwartzman's performance, and I really do, it's really amazing how he walks a line here. And I think my son Holden put it best where he said, yeah, I like him. He's always walking the line between being a genius and a moron. And yes, that's true. And that's a high wire act, and he absolutely nails it. But maybe there's just something about the mature version of that character, especially as played by Gene Hackman, and the bitter sweetness that surrounds him that speaks to me more than the obnoxious kid who is so impressed with himself in a movie that maybe seems a little impressed with itself as well. I don't know. I'm coming at this not trying to pick a fight, because I'm trying to see it the way you see it and the way Sam sees it, the way so many people do, because I really do like the movie. But I also, as I mentioned, haven't been able to completely pinpoint what keeps me from loving it with that Max Fisher-like intensity.
Well, and I should say, it's not like for me, there's a huge gap between my love for Rushmore or the Royal Tenenbaums. If anything, it's just more of a personal attachment to what's going on in Rushmore. It's certainly, you know, Rushmore, we've been talking about this in terms of the references at Interruptus. It very much feels like a second film. It's someone who is still possibly shedding influences on screen.
Yep.
And so the Royal Tenenbaums is certainly Anderson coming into his full powers.
Right.
And I think there's something thrilling about seeing that happen. As a huge fan of his, that is what excites me about the Royal Tenenbaums. Why do I enjoy Rushmore a bit more? I think what Holden said about Max is part of it, though I would say it is somewhat, you know, genius slash moron. I would say more it's juvenile slash mature. And there are specific scenes, many of them, where Max, you think, is going to pull off this conversation with Bloom at the wrestling match, where he offers to pay for the popcorn. A very adult gesture, right?
Yes.
And it seems to go over well. And then he says something like, were you in the shit about Vietnam? Which is another attempt at adult social connection, but it's completely inappropriate. And so there's something joyous about watching. For me, it's why I consider it, you know, if not the best coming of age movie of all time, one of the best, and certainly my personal favorite. There's something about watching a kid on that cusp and constantly going back and forth, stepping on his own toes, having potential that I never, ever tire of. Yeah. And I'm not one who, you know, I will take Wes Anderson's fussiness. I have not tired of it yet. I understand why some people have. But there is something a little looser about Rushmore compared to the Royal Tenenbaums.
Sure.
That I think makes it me have a little more affection for it, I guess.
Yeah. I wonder if it's something in Max's arrogance and his lack of vulnerability, which isn't to say it doesn't come through in moments, and certainly by the end of the film it does. And maybe I feel like I see those chinks in the armor a little bit more with Royal, who makes him a more compelling character. But again, that's what comes with wisdom. And that's the whole point. He is a character who is still coming of age and at 15, very much defining himself. But I think maybe that's why one of the scenes for me, and I'm curious if it was a scene that stuck out in terms of the ones you talked about at Interrupt Us that really resonated, was the scene at the airport hangar with the kite, where he's with Dirk and Margaret Yang shows up with her remote control airplane. It's a scene where we hear Max say he's sorry twice, which I'm pretty sure we've never heard him really admit at that point, or at least mean it as genuinely and as warmly as he does there. But I just love the moment. And in some ways, you could argue, why is it even there? It's not a line that's essential to the plot in any way. But when Margaret admits that she cheated on her science experiment, it seems to me that that's the moment where Max, who up to this point has kind of rejected her for maybe a variety of reasons, he finally sees that she, who comes off as so perfect, in some ways a variation on the character that he's dreaming about seeing himself as at the beginning of the film, maybe not beloved in that way, but the way he goes up to the board and just very flippantly solves that incredibly difficult math problem. Margaret's that kind of character, and she's framed at one point at that science experiment in a similar way to when he's celebrated for his intellectual achievement. But he sees in her, I think in that moment, that she's actually really flawed, and she, like him, is idealistic to a fault. I believe this so much, I can't be wrong, so who cares if I have to fake something to prove it? He's an ends justifies the means kind of character, absolutely. And that shows that she is too, to an extent. So he feels a genuine connection with her there in that moment. And I think, too, just the gesture by Dirk to see if he wants to fly the kite, and that moment where he does come back to life, finally, after being kicked out of Rushmore and realize that he can still be that person, even if he's not in that space. That's where the movie really all does come together for me.
Take dictation, please. Possible candidates for Kite Flying Society. David Connors, Murray Marshall, Greg Holloway, Duncan Wright, Margaret Yang, Woody Jackson, Shushan.
Where
Benedict,
I end up, well, I think Buck. Only God really knows.
That's the tear scene for me. Every Wes Anderson movie has a tear scene where one just kind of sneaks out. I don't know why. I didn't expect it. The scene hasn't been building up to it.
Did you cry in front of a crowd, Josh?
No, I didn't today. But it has happened more than once with that scene. And it's a lot of what you're talking about. It's also what I would call most of Anderson's films have this, the epiphany scene, where the character comes to, and it doesn't have to be a major awareness about themselves, even just a minor one. And this is it, as you said, for Max. And it's also, he has opened up himself to others in this scene, Margaret and Dirk, but he's learned that that doesn't mean having to completely subsume his own ambitions and interests and personalities.
Right.
And so
that's the trick
there's
of it,
that,
really. Yeah.
That is the trick. And that's maturation, right? This is where he's learning what it means to be mature. He wants to be an adult. He wants to be in charge. And in his rush to do that, he leaves no room for anyone else.
But let me ask real quick, though. Do you think it's possible that Anderson, at least Anderson the director, I don't know about Anderson the person, but in his work, he might think that this is what happens in art. This is what can happen in art, is that you can create a character who can connect with other people and be part of a community and be part of a society, but still retain all of their individuality. And maybe in real life, that doesn't happen, or it doesn't happen certainly as easily.
Well, it's interesting to think of in him in terms of being a director. You would say got to be a control freak, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, look at the way his stamp is on all these movies. But if you look at the credits, you see that how frequently he works with co-writers, how frequently he works with music composers and switches up the type of music he uses in his films, the leeway he gives to Bill Murray. And we certainly have to get to Bill Murray before we're done with this conversation. So yeah, he seems to be a director that looks very stringent and like a control freak, but what he produces does seem to come out of community too. And there's a very small detail. There's two details in that kite flying scene I want to mention. The one is you talked about Dirk handing Max the kite string, and Max starts saying, take dictation, lists the people who are in the kite flying society he wants to found. And he does, Schwartzman does this little like zigzag shrug with his shoulder. And it's like, he's back. He's got it back.
That's it.
Yet at the same time, he's including Margaret. He invites her to be on that. And when we return to that parking lot later, there is the club letter stamp that says kite flying society co-founders. And it's just a little detail.
Yeah.
It shows you
that
he's,
great point.
He's given some authorship to, I'm assuming, Dirk as well.
Mm-hmm. I do want to talk about Bill Murray. And first, I want to mention that as you're talking about collaborators, Owen Wilson was a co-screenwriter on this film,
yes,
if I'm remembering correctly, as he on his first film, Bottle Rocket, as well. But let's talk Murray, because there are so many moments with him that I appreciate. And I'll give you one. It's, again, near the end of the film where Max, for the first time, introduces his father to Herman properly as a barber, right? And he has had this charade up to this point that his father was a neurosurgeon, that he came from, let's say, greater stock. And Murray's reaction, just so subtle, but kind of an inhale where you can tell that there's a certain surprise, but more than that, a recognition that Max really is this vulnerable kid. And it's other moments too. It is, as I said, reacting to the film a little bit like Herman when he responds to something, when he's impressed by something that Max does. There are just wonderful little touches. Every one of those smiles is just a little bit different. He finds variations on ways to show his appreciation and his connection to Max as a character. That said, let me just throw it out there. What is so transcendent for you and so many other people about this performance? Because I think it's very, very good, but there's a part of me that wonders if it was so groundbreaking at the time in terms of being a paradigm shift for what we expected from a Bill Murray performance, so subdued, so subtle. The mischievousness, I guess, really only comes out in some of those sly grins and reactions. So he finds a way to sublimate that and yet not ever be boring on screen. But I wonder if over the past 20 years, essentially, we've given him a lot of credit for this movie being the point at which there was that departure and he started to make really interesting decisions about his characters and the films he chose to do. Is he given too much credit for this performance? It sounds like there's no way you're going to say yes.
I don't think he's given too much credit. There's so much going on. And the barbershop scene you mentioned, we could start with that. It is the grin he gives, but it's also the decision that he makes, both as an actor and the character's decision. He's going to keep the secret. He's not going to tell Max's dad or even indicate that there's something amiss here, that Max had been lying about his dad's profession, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the character decision, which is interesting. And then the fact that Murray can communicate to us that thought process going on with that little pause, the look that he gives, and then he decides to move forward by just letting Max's lie pass by for the good of them all. And I think you see that happening a lot in his scenes. That's the subtlety at play. But you're right. He's also never boring. You know, he's just walking past some little kids playing basketball and he decides to reject one of the kids' shots for no apparent reason. I think there's also, it was a turning point for me, at least, in terms of Murray's persona, because there is a newfound vulnerability in this performance that he tapped into, that he's carried over since then in a lot of his work, almost all of his work. Mm-hmm. It's not just the vulnerability of standing with the beer belly and the Budweiser shorts on the diving board, you know, when Bloom is drunk at his kid's birthday party. That's the sort of, yes, it's a vulnerable moment for Bloom, but it's also funny, right? Murray is playing a joke there. It's the vulnerability you see with his bratty kids in other scenes where they get the best of him. Those those evil twins, right?
Ronnie and Donnie, is that it?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, he can't even tell the difference anymore some point. But they get the best of him. And this is a Murray character who, there are scenes in this movie where he's the butt of the joke. And if you think about how he came on the screen, and we've talked about some of his early work, he was always the guy that got everybody else in the scene. Mm-hmm. He played the joke on them.
Yeah.
He was the snarky winner. And this is a straight out loser. We have some affection for him because he's funny, but this is a guy whose life is crumbling. It's falling apart. He kind of wants it to fall apart. Mm-hmm. He seems to be so miserable. And there is enough here where Murray taps into that as a genuine human emotion beyond the humor that is also at play. So I guess for me, it's just one of the first times, haven't seen every single performance Murray has given, and I know he experimented before Rushmore with things, but for me, it was one of the first times that I saw this other side that he was open to exploring and open to being, you know, the butt of a joke in a scene.
Yeah, no, that's definitely all there. Any closing thoughts? I mean, you've gone through this film now frame by frame. I asked you what insights you gleaned. Were there any nuggets, things you absolutely had no concept of, and you came away from this experience having your mind blown a little bit?
So it's really the references that are interesting to me, because I don't always pick up on those immediately. It's just not how my mind works. So it's been great having people in the audience point to, like, hey, the background of that building mirrors the background of North by Northwest, where they're at United Nations. And that's exactly what is being, they're going for that sort of intrigue,
right,
sensibility in that scene. So things like that have been good. Those are minor. Really, the mind-blowing thing has been that I've always wanted to watch Harold and Maude this week because the first day that came up as one of the references, the Hal Ashby film, and I just had to admit, you know, people in the audience said, well, you've seen Harold and Maude, right?
Because the shame. This is the shame.
Adam, there were boos. Like, I was booed.
So deserved.
Yeah, because you've seen every film ever made.
Yes,
so
of course.
I thought, man, I can't go back to these people the next day and not have watched Harold and Maude.
So you came in and you said, and I've rated it on Rotten Tomatoes, and now I'm the only person who doesn't like it.
It's no longer 100%.
Right.
No, watched it this morning, really enjoyed it. It's delightful. And yes, Rushmore owes so much to it in the relationships at play between a younger man and an older woman, of course, and just the general tone. Maybe we'll do a Harold and Maude Sacred Cow at some point, and we can get into the differences for me in terms of calibration, the way that I think Wes Anderson calibrates the tone that Ashby is going for and mostly gets in Harold and Maude. But certainly I don't see Rushmore as any sort of copy. It's maybe progressing in that really unique tradition that Ashby was a part of earlier. So that's kind of been my mind-blowing experience, is finally getting to check Harold and Maude off the list.
Well, I think that is a great candidate for a Sacred Cow, even though usually we're picking films that we both have seen before and we both saw them some time ago. We can, of course, make exceptions, but I saw Harold and Maude probably for the first time after Film Spotting started, so post-2005, because, like you, I felt shame. It kept coming up over and over again, and I really liked it, but it never really got discussed on the show. I've never reviewed it. I remember certain images and scenes from it, but I wouldn't say vividly. It has been over 10 years now, so I think that's one we definitely need to think about. That's Harold and Maude, which you can find in a variety of places, I'm sure, if you need to see it. Rushmore is currently available to rent or stream on most platforms. Also, some Max Fisher wannabe is probably staging a very authentic production of the film at an exclusive private school near you. So look out for that. And I do have to give Sam some credit for a note he had. We were talking earlier today in our Slack, and he mentioned that Schwartzman's so good that when he's in the whole heaven and earth thing at the end, the staged play, he is actually really bad as an actor. So he's really good at playing bad in that scene.
He is. And though you will note, there is an improvement in Max's plays from Serpico.
Sure.
How professional that is to Heaven or Hell, which is just another nice twist on his maturation progress.
Yeah, that does remind me, though. I do want to quickly point out that one of the things that struck me visually here, one of the motifs we talked about in The Royal Tenenbaums, how there's that constant use of windows where people are often framed by them. They're inside mm-hmm. or outside the house, inside or outside this family unit. Here, there are a ton of curtains. And sometimes those curtains are attached to windows, but sometimes they are just like curtains where Max seems to always be emerging. He's constantly making entrances, which of course is so fitting because he plays his life like he's a character on stage. There's always a performance element to it. And that's how the movie concludes too. After that final shot is framed,
yes,
the curtains close. So there, Wes Anderson making that very explicitly clear. If you've seen Rushmore recently and agree or disagree with our thoughts, email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
All right, time to crown a champion, Adam. It's been brutal, it's been bloody, but Film Spotting Madness has come to an end, and we have a winner. We'll reveal the champ next and hear Adam's conversation with American anarchist director Charlie Siskel. Stay with us.
I listen to the wind of my soul. Where I'll end up, well, I think only God really knows. I've sat upon the setting sun, but never, 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 never. I never wanted water once, no, never, never, never.
How many up there?
Three or four.
Best count, our guy?
Not sure.
So that means it could be up to five guys up there?
It's possible.
We should have shotguns.
What's that old expression? Josh, never bring a knife to a shotgun fight, something like that?
Or maybe a horse's head? I guess we'll find out.
We will. John Travolta and Samuel L. Jackson in Pulp Fiction, one half of our Film Spotting Madness championship match. Tarantino's film going up against Francis Ford Coppola's The Godfather in the final. This is the culmination of many weeks of Film Spotting Madness, the third year of Film Spotting Madness. We started with actors and actresses. We then went to directors, crown champions there. Originally, Michael Fassbender and the Coen brothers, the winner last year as Film Spotting Nation's favorite filmmakers. We are now going to crown a champion from the list of our Pantheon films here at Film Spotting, movies we love, and we've set them aside. They're ineligible for top five consideration, and some of our sacred cow reviews. So now Rushmore, a film not currently in the Pantheon, it would have been eligible now for something like Film Spotting Madness because it has been given the sacred cow treatment.
And it probably would have been voted out fairly early, and
maybe
I would have really cried at that point.
Maybe so, but we're gonna come back to Rushmore. It may have a second life in a future edition of Film Spotting Madness. We will cover that in a moment. But you are right in the sense that The Royal Tenenbaums, anyway, lost in the first round, as I recall.
It was early. Yep.
It was early, but it had some really stiff competition. These are some of the greatest films ever. So 65 movies with a play-in game, now culminating with the final two, The Godfather versus Pulp Fiction. And a reminder here on how The Godfather got here. It beat Young Frankenstein in round one, Before Sunrise in round two, Alien in round three, Casablanca in the Elite Eight, in 2001, A Space Odyssey in the Final Four. If The Godfather wins, you can't say it hasn't gone up against really stiff competition, Josh.
Oh, man, those last three in particular.
Yep.
So here was Pulp Fiction's path to possible victory. In the first round, it beat Cool Hand Luke, then took out Rio Bravo in round two, Goodfellas in round three. And I don't know, this had some Godfather fans worried that Pulp Fiction beat Godfather Part Two in the Elite Eight.
Mm-hmm.
So what did that mean for this championship round? We'll see. Finally, it did take out Empire Strikes Back in the Final Four.
Isaac Rosso Klakovich in Chapel Hill, North Carolina writes, I'm currently feeling a failure to communicate between myself and the rest of Film Spotting Nation. I voted for Cool Hand Luke over Pulp Fiction way back in the first round. However, I'm somehow about to cast my vote for it to be crowned the champion of Film Spotting Madness. And if that doesn't encapsulate Film Spotting Madness, I don't know what does.
pretty much does, Isaac. We heard from Scott in Burlington, Vermont. Oh, Film Spotting Madness, you have been so disappointing on so many levels. The Godfather, really? As Ebert once said about The Godfather, even though he loved the film, it only works in a closed world. You have to be tricked into caring about these characters. Sorry, I wasn't. Are we supposed to be impressed by bullies, charmed by violence, inspired by cruelty? Are we really this shallow? Is narcissism the new American virtue? And though I love Pulp Fiction and would certainly vote for it over hashtag Godfather so white, where is the film that will help us navigate past our own extinction? The last film on Earth will almost certainly take on religious significance, and these two lack any moral depth. I guess if we are going to destroy ourselves, let's have our bellies full of quarter pounders and cheese. And wow. Yeah, that's how we are thinking about this. This is the only film
that's
going to remain. Yep. All the others destroyed.
When you pick against a movie, you are saying you prefer this other movie to live on forever, and the other film, The Loser, is destroyed. So at least we know the stakes of Film Spotting Madness. But Scott, so much to respond to. I'll just say caring about characters is kind of a misguided position. But more than that, how can you talk about Pulp Fiction and needing a film to take on religious significance and not think about I Am the Shepherd? It's a movie all about redemption. There's a moral core to Pulp Fiction that we talked about during our Sacred Cow review of that movie. I think for Scott, Pulp Fiction should absolutely qualify. Jason Radigan in New York City. This is how Trump got elected. Pulp Fiction unaccountably beating better institutional names because it's louder, crasser, and more quotable. Did Empire, Godfather 2, Goodfellas, or Cool Hand Luke deserve the crown? No, or maybe. But America deserved a choice. Is The Godfather, the epitome of our post-Golden Age institutional film, the absolute best choice? Possibly, but it's our last hope for a sane future where truth has its place, even if the winner is less than perfect. We've got revenge voting, voting in ignorance, and folks who just want to watch the world burn. Then there are those who genuinely believe that Pulp Fiction is the better film, condemning everyone to the terrible, obvious, foreseeable fact that when left with only one film, we realize that 2 months of this buffoonery was more than we could stand. Sad.
Wow. Jason blaming Trump for this too, huh?
Yeah, I suppose. Okay. And it sounds like us. It sounds like we have wasted 2 months of his time. We apologize.
Joe Schlitz from Berlin, Germany said, if we're going to let this apocalyptic doomsday scenario play out, here's one more thing to consider. What's the movie, the one movie, that we're going to want to leave behind for future generations as a testament to what film was capable of achieving? What do we want to leave behind to stand next to the masterpieces of the other art forms, next to Shakespeare and Dante, next to Michelangelo and Beethoven and all of that? If you look at it that way, it seems pretty clear to me that The Godfather is the only right choice. Pulp Fiction is, sure, a very creative, very fun, very clever movie, but at the end of the day, I honestly don't know if there's much more to it than that. It doesn't really aspire or manage to be anything other than cool. Maybe really cool, maybe super duper badass cool, but that's all there is. The Godfather, on the other hand, is a masterpiece that seriously tries to wrestle with timeless human themes like sin, family, and fate. 500 years from now, I don't think people would be embarrassed to put it next to something like Macbeth. So, when future generations reflect on the art form that dominated the 20th century and dominated our lives, I want them to know that we were capable of thinking and feeling, along with the other big shots of the human artistic tradition. I don't want them to think that we were just a bunch of silly badasses.
Yeah, that does remind me that I was going to refute what Scott was saying earlier about The Godfather by pointing out that you probably wouldn't love something like King Lear if caring about the characters was of paramount importance. Thank you, Joe, for that. Shane Adam says, after rewatching both of the film finalists in preparation for my vote, I love someone doing homework, Josh. I'm confident saying that while Pulp Fiction was a definitive moment in my shallow cinema-loving history, The Godfather continues to open my eyes to its delights in new ways each time. Leave the pulp, take the cannoli. And it seems, Josh, that a majority of our listeners did follow that advice.
The Godfather takes it with 62% of the vote, leaving Pulp Fiction with only 38%. I really thought this would be closer.
I did too. I thought it would definitely be closer. And you have to say,
and you bet on Pulp, right?
Yeah, I had Pulp Fiction winning it all. It would have been pretty incredible had Pulp Fiction taken down both The Godfather 2 and The Godfather. And as Michael said here on the show, as I've suggested before, many people say it, The Godfather 2 might actually be the better movie, but The Godfather is the original, and it is the one that took down Pulp Fiction 62% to 38%. The Godfather was the number one overall seed, which I suppose means that we did our work properly in terms of seeding these films. You certainly can't say that it had an easy path to the number one overall slot, taking down those films that we listed, especially, as you noted, Josh, those last three.
Yeah, not at all. And now we get to watch The Godfather over and over. I'm getting a picture of this Film Spotting Madness universe. So we've got The Godfather, and we have the Coen brothers directing Michael Fassbender in all films, right?
That's it.
What we're kind of left with. Or the three of them are just sitting around watching The Godfather. I don't know.
Yeah, or do the Coen brothers have to remake The Godfather with Michael Fassbender as Michael Corleone? Is that it?
I could be into that.
Yeah, I could too. Okay, so we did decide to do a loser match here. The third place finish, 2001, A Space Odyssey versus The Empire Strikes Back. So I don't know, this kind of defies everything we've said up to now, Josh, about the stakes of Film Spotting Madness if all of a sudden maybe a second film gets to survive.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah.
We didn't think this through, but it was between 2001 and Empire, and this one a bit closer than our final.
Yeah, this one, 2001 takes, but with 57% of the vote compared to Empire's 43%. I think, you know, we really just wanted another chance at one more nonsensical matchup, and this certainly was it. This was a hard one for me to even pick.
Well, we thank everyone who participated in Film Spotting Madness, everyone who listened to all the buffoonery over these past 6 weeks or so. And before we put Film Spotting Madness to bed for another year, we do have one final thought from Film Spotting Madness founding father, Mike Merrigan in Dover, New Hampshire.
Hello, Adam, Josh, and Sam. Congratulations on another Film Spotting Madness. Well done. I have to say, I'm not surprised at the outcome, but you would have thought that Pulp Fiction stood a chance, having already bested both Goodfellas and The Godfather Part II. You would have expected it to cruise right past The Godfather, but in the end, Film Spotting Nation just couldn't overlook an absolute masterpiece. I have to say, if I could do it all over again, I might just declare Young Frankenstein the winner, take my popcorn, and go home. Importantly, most importantly, the words, Mike Merrigan cannot possibly lose Film Spotting Madness, absolute music. Thanks again. I look forward to seeing what the rest of the listeners give Josh. Let's just call it Josh. It's definitely going to be Josh to watch as the punishment for this year's Film Spotting Madness. Thank you to everybody that voted and participated. We can all breathe a big collective sigh of relief that finally this madness is behind us. Until next time. Bye, guys.
Thank you, Mike, for your approval. It does mean so much. And indeed, Mike Merrigan can't lose. Mike Merrigan didn't lose. And Josh Larson, for the second year in a row, did.
Mission to Moscow. Here I come.
Here you come.
Someone tweeted that there's yet another Adam Sandler straight to Netflix movie.
Yes.
So, you know what?
Yeah,
we like tradition here on the show. I think that should maybe be it.
Yeah, I think that is the way to go. You had a great response, which is basically it seems as if Adam Sandler is making movies just to supply the loser of Film Spotting Madness with something to watch. So how can we rebuff that?
Yeah, I can't think of any other reason for him to be doing this.
Yeah, we do like to fill out our brackets, try to predict how it's going to play out. Josh, in last place, 70 points. He had Empire versus Raiders in the final. Mike, 82 points, had Jaws winning it all. And that went out in the second round. But I believe it lost to Citizen Kane. So, you know, you got to give some credit to Jaws and Spielberg there. I finished in second with 92 points. Having Pulp Fiction in the final, I had it winning it all, was obviously a fairly astute prediction on my part, but Tarantino's film just didn't have the juice.
Kudos to you for not waging a pro-Pulp Fiction campaign on social media in the last week. That was I was quite proud of you for that.
Thank you. You're right. I could have done that. I chose not to, but that means Sam Van Hallgren is the Film Spotting Madness winner. He called the Godfather win. He was smart enough to go, hey, I'm the guy who helped make it the number one seed. Maybe I should go with
that prediction
to win it all. 145 points. He just cleaned our clocks, Josh.
Well, and
mainly yours,
you say
but
it
he
that
cleaned
way,
our clocks.
Yeah, uh-huh. When you say it that way, like we had it seeded at number one, why didn't all four of us just
exactly?
You know, it's like this thing, it messes with your heads, man. I mean, you get in the thick of it and you lose all common sense.
Right. Well, we'll have more information about the film that Josh is going to have to watch, that Adam Sandler film, which I have no idea what it's even called. We'll link to it in our show notes. You can watch it too and maybe agree or disagree with Josh's take on it here on a future edition of Film Spotting. So
yeah, we'll dedicate a whole segment to it, I'm sure.
We should, right? A whole review. Why not? 30 minutes. That's the end of Film Spotting Madness 2021. 17. I think this edition with these Pantheon films was by far my favorite yet.
It was the hardest. You know, these were the hardest decisions to make for sure.
Yeah, we have a quick note from Cole Bauer in Minneapolis to help us wrap things up and look ahead a little bit. Just wanted to write a quick message on a job well done with this year's Madness. It was a heck of a lot of fun, and it's always enjoyable listening to how much you guys get into it and how much fun other listeners have as well. Can't wait for next year. P.S. I'm trying to imagine a film spotting quiz. Which Godfather character are you? Where Adam doesn't try to make the argument that Josh is Fredo for having come in last 2 years in a row. It's okay, Josh. Perhaps Blue Apron can offer you a complimentary lasagna meal. Madness, I say. Madness.
I'm sure they have one of those.
You know they do. Something with quinoa in it, and it will be delicious. P.P.S. Have you guys thought of a theme for next year? I was thinking a movie heroes versus villains bracket would be fun. 32 heroes on one side, 32 villains on the other, narrowing it down to one epic battle for supremacy of the cinematic universe. It would be interesting to see how people would justify their choices. Would Darth Vader run the gamut to the final? Would the debate over Freddy Krueger versus Jason Voorhees finally be settled? How would the merits of the moral distinction of Atticus Finch versus the physical fortitude of Rocky Balboa be discerned? And what about Arnold of the Terminator on the villain side and Arnold of T2 on the hero side? Mind blown, Cole says.
I really like this idea.
I do too.
And would love to do it. But hasn't Sam been cooking something up in the film spotting kitchen for another edition of Film Spotting Madness?
Actually, in this case, Sam usually deserves the credit for anything good that happens on the show. But it was my idea. I was looking ahead because I was recognizing that we're getting pretty close here in 2017 to the end of another decade. And we may be doing, perhaps at some point, our top 20 films or our top 10 films, whatever the number will be, of this past decade, 2010 to 2019. And so I thought, well, couldn't we, at least in 2019, do that for Film Spotting Madness? We take all the films from this decade, 64 of the best films, and let them duke it out. So if that's Film Spotting Madness 2020, and that's coming off, Josh, the two of us presumably sharing our lists of our favorite films and then growing that into 64. Why couldn't we do the best of the early 2000s in 2019 and then 2018 next year? Let's do the best of the 90s. We'll pick a different decade leading up perfectly to be in sync with the end of this decade.
Yeah, that kind of lines up too well to resist, doesn't it?
It does, even though this one so far, I have to say, Cole, I'll give you credit. We've had a lot of really good ideas come in suggesting what next year's Madness or a future Madness could be. The heroes versus villains is my favorite one, and hopefully we'll keep this going, and maybe that's what we'll do in 2021. But we do have a plan, and I think the best of the 90s will be a real challenge and will be a fun challenge because behind the scenes, Sam and I have already started forming that list of 64 movies. And Josh, there are, I'd say, at least 36 movies that Sam and I agree on and you would agree that are no-brainers. They have to be in that list in terms of how we feel about them, in terms of how most of the world feels about them. But after that, those last 28 or so slots, there are at least 45 movies that belong in those 28 slots, and we'll have to see how we end up deciding which ones they'll be. But it raises the question, is a movie like Rushmore gonna have a chance to really go deep in the 90s edition of Film Spotting Madness? And the other thing we have to think about is, what do we do with Pulp Fiction? Because,
well, I was just gonna say, this could be the chance for Pulp Fiction to claim the crown.
That's it. And I had mentioned to Sam, and he agreed with me, that if Pulp Fiction won it all, won the Pantheon edition of Madness this year, then maybe it would have made sense to set it aside. Don't let it compete in the 90s edition. But whatever film then is the winner, we do one extra battle where it has to compete against Pulp Fiction for 90s supremacy. But maybe it'd just be more interesting to not have Pulp Fiction be a part of it if our listeners had decided it's one of the best films of all time. We're not going to have to make that decision. Yeah,
no, it's got a chip on its shoulder now. So.
Yeah. Yeah, so maybe we will include it. And I'll give everybody a little sneak peek of what it's going to look like. I think right now, if I remember correctly, the top four seeds for Film Spotting Madness 1990s edition are Goodfellas, Pulp Fiction, The Big Lebowski, and Fargo. Two Coen Brothers movies in the top four. But I know you don't have the entire list in front of you, but how do you not say that those four movies would be the top four strongest contenders?
I mean, I resist having two from the same filmmakers up there. But then again, with the Coens winning Film Spotting Madness previously, that does make sense. So yeah.
Exactly. Rushmore currently slotted at 9, the 9th overall seed. So we are excited already about what Film Spotting Madness will be next year, as we do plan to do the 1990s. With Film Spotting Madness all wrapped up for the year, we get back into our regular bi-weekly poll questions. I don't know if there's really a buildup for that, Josh. We've had so much fun with Madness. We're going to try to generate some excitement for these polls. We know it's treading water a little bit until we get to that 1990s Madness. But for this week's question, we turn our attention to Miss Emma Watson. You've seen her, Josh, in Beauty and the Beast. She also stars in the film we're looking to discuss a couple weeks from now, The Circle, a corporate thriller that co-stars Watson and Tom Hanks, and it's directed by James Ponsoldt, who did The End of the Tour and Spectacular. Now, since her turn as Hermione in Harry Potter, that series ending in 2011, she's kept pretty busy. She was in The Bling Ring. She was in Darren Aronofsky's Noah, The Perks of Being a Wallflower, and now Beauty and the Beast, as we said, which I think has earned a kajillion dollars or something. Very successful movie. According to our crack research team, Watson was born in 1990, April 15th to be exact, so happy birthday, Emma. Also born in 1990, a few other prominent young actresses: Jennifer Lawrence, who already won an Oscar in 2013 for Silver Linings Playbook; Kristen Stewart, critical darling of late and the subject of a recent top five here on the show; and a star on the rise, Margot Robbie. She was Harley Quinn in Suicide Squad and very memorable in Martin Scorsese's The Wolf of Wall Street. And that brings us to our question, Josh.
You have four movies to choose from. The only thing you know about them is that they star one of these actresses. Whose movie do you choose? So those choices, again, are Jennifer Lawrence, Margot Robbie, Kristen Stewart, or Emma Watson. We're not going to go with an other option here, but if you want to throw in, you know, a write-in like Lola Kirk, that's fine. Lola Kirk, of course, from Gone Girl, Mistress America. I've been catching up with her in Mozart in the Jungle, the Amazon series, right? Yep. Isn't that where,
it is? So, and I devoured season one, and then I got sidetracked, and I haven't been back to it.
She's quite good in
But she's good, and I like that series. Gael Garcia Bernal, one of the stars of that series as well. So, Josh, where are you going with this one? I mean, I know you're an Emma fan, or at least I assume you are, because you're a fan generally of all things Potter, but are you going to go Lawrence instead?
Yeah, I got to go Lawrence, and this is difficult because it's between Watson, Stewart, and Lawrence for me. I just, Robbie, I just have not seen quite enough from her, or at least at the level of other things the other three have done. Lawrence is just the one who could surprise me the most, I think. There's just, you don't know what direction she's going to take something. And particularly if it's an unknown movie, that's a quality I want.
I'm going Kristen Stewart, and it's not just recency bias.
Shocker.
I'm going with her because the question is, if you only know one thing about the film and it's that they're the star, well, I know two things about the film, and that is, there's at least a really, really good chance that she's made a wonderful choice of director and material, and she's doing something different and probably a little bit edgy, and it's going to be good. That's her track record recently. Not that Lawrence doesn't have a pretty good track record, but
Lawrence's recent track record has been a bit spottier. I'll give you that.
Yep. You can vote now at filmspotting.net. And if you leave a comment, and we hope you do, please let us know where you're listening from. When we come back here from a short break, we will have my conversation with Charlie Siskel, the director of the new doc, American Anarchist. Stay with us.
I am waiting. I am waiting. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I am waiting. I am waiting. Someone to come out of somewhere, waiting for someone to come out of somewhere. You can't hold out, you can't hold out. Oh yeah, oh yeah. You can't hold out, you can't hold out. Oh yeah, oh yeah. Waiting for someone to come out of somewhere. Waiting for someone.
You know, we talk about the cliche of the skeleton in the closet. Well, my skeleton's not in the closet. My skeleton is in print. And I live with that.
The trailer for the new documentary, American Anarchist, from director Charlie Siskel. Siskel was the co-director of Finding Vivian Maier, which was Oscar-nominated for Best Documentary Feature in 2013. The subject of Siskel's new film is Bill Powell, author of The Anarchist Cookbook. Powell wrote the book in the early 70s at the height of the anti-Vietnam War counterculture movement. Most notoriously, it contains instructions for making explosives along with a whole host of other types of weapons. The book went on to be linked to several acts of violence, including the Columbine school shootings in 1999. Powell was only 19 when the book was published, and he has since renounced it, but the time it took for him to make that renunciation and his ambivalent feelings about how much responsibility he should have for the book's troubling legacy make him a fascinating subject. I got a chance to speak with Siskel earlier this week, and as you'll hear in the interview, I note how I'm fascinated by how documentaries come together, how unlike narrative films, they can come to be defined by the unexpected. And I think Siskel has some good insight on what he set out to do with American Anarchist and how that shifted as the film came together. And we finished our talk with Siskel pulling top five duty. I asked him to share his top five documentaries that had the most influence on him. Here's that interview. Charlie, I'm always fascinated by the process of making documentaries, all the choices a director has to make, and I want to really explore that process here. But first, how did it start? What provoked your interest in this subject, whether it was Bill Powell, the person, the book, The Anarchist Cookbook, or something else? And did you have to convince Bill to participate?
Well, I knew about the book when I was probably younger than I should have. I knew about it because I had an older cousin who had the book on his bookshelf, and I imagine he was the kind of kid who had it to make his parents angry or to frighten, you know, the other neighborhood kids or something. He certainly wasn't using it to blow anything up or make other of the recipes in his kitchen. So I was familiar with The Anarchist Cookbook as a sort of taboo kind of cult status object for a long time. And I worked on the film Bowling for Columbine with Michael Moore, and we mentioned the book in that film. And it was, you know, influential and associated with some acts of violence during that period. So I was reacquainted with the book then, but it kind of dovetailed with my interest in the late 60s, early 70s, just as a student of recent American history. I've always been interested in that period of the late 60s when the protests over Vietnam treatment of American citizens at the hands of the police turned more and more violent. And violence was happening on both sides, both by the police and by protesters who kind of grew impatient of peaceful protest and started to advocate violence. Different groups did. And so Bill Powell, who wrote The Anarchist Cookbook at 19 years old during that period of the late 60s, early 70s, kind of brought both of those interests together. He was not a member of the Students for a Democratic Society or, you know, the New Left. He was not a member of the Weathermen or the Weather Underground. He was on the fringe of that movement, the peace movement, the protest movement, and he was, you know, a young teenager living in New York City during that period. He was angry about the war in Vietnam. He was angry about the treatment of American citizens at the hands of police and other authorities. And the book grew out of that. And so I was always curious what happened to the guy who wrote that book. And I found a couple of interviews with him over the years, and it turned out that he had written an apologia of sorts about the book, distanced himself from the book, said he no longer agreed with it, but he had kind of disappeared. And so I tracked him down and I guess had to persuade him to be involved in the project. He initially was not interested. He had not granted many interviews over the years and had kind of avoided any media. But I talked to him about the kind of film I was interested in making. He didn't think that his life was worthy of treatment in film, but I felt otherwise and said that if he was, you know, willing to open up about his experience of writing the book and his experience in the aftermath that I thought people could learn a lot from him. And luckily, he was willing to participate.
Yeah, I want to come back to the type of film you were looking to make in a second. But what did Bill Powell agree to up front? How many interviews? How much filming? And did those expectations shift as you got deeper into filming?
I am a fan of Errol Morris's films, and I find character studies in documentaries, you know, fascinating to watch when you have a great character with an interesting story to tell. I find it fascinating to focus in on the individual's story and their choices and try to peel back the layers of storytelling, denial, justification, explaining, and all of the different colors of that sort of thing. I find that fascinating. And so I thought that Bill, if he was willing to explore his past and the decisions that he made and examine them, that could be compelling. And that was what I was interested in. But in particular, I told him that I thought that the writing of the book at such a young age and the fact that he grew to regret it or to feel remorse over the book and disavowed it because he learned that it had been associated with acts of violence, I thought that other people could learn from that. And, you know, his youthful mistake in writing this book played out in an incredibly public way and with, you know, with associations that had to be incredibly difficult and troubling to him. And I wanted to examine that. And that was what he agreed to do.
You mentioned this a little bit. What were your expectations then going in? Did you have a specific question or questions you needed answered? Of course, you had lots of questions for Bill, but I'm thinking more dramatically and thematically. What did you think this movie was ultimately going to be about?
I thought it would be about a man coming to terms with his past and making sense of the choices that he had made and examining his own conduct. And elements of that I thought would be easier to talk about, specifically the things that Bill had already spoken about publicly in the few statements that he had made. He wrote a blurb on Amazon so that if you buy the book and you read the author's statement as you're purchasing the book, you would learn that Bill Powell, the man who wrote it at the age of 19, that he no longer agreed with the book and didn't believe in violence. And he had made one other public statement after a school shooting in 2013 when he learned that the person who did the shooting had a copy of the book and had been reading it up until that time. And so I think those examples really drove home for Bill the need to speak out publicly. So he had already done that, and I certainly wanted to examine that. But there were other things that I thought would be harder for him to discuss and justify, specifically the fact that he didn't speak out until the year 2000, and the book was written in 1970, and that it had been associated or connected with acts of violence throughout that period, in the 70s, the 80s, the 90s. What took him so long? What was he doing during that period? Would he defend the book on any level? And did he, once he decided that the book was wrong, did he act on that in any way? And if not, why not? And I learned that he had received income from the book. Obviously, he was the author of the book. He wrote it, and it was published and sold over 2 million copies, I think. And so he made a great deal of money from the book, or at least a fair amount of money. What did he do with all that money? Did he have any misgivings about that? Did he do anything else to distance himself publicly or in any way from the book? And were there costs for him personally in having written the book? Did the book haunt him in some way? I suspected that it did, and that was my intuition, and I wanted to explore that.
I can see that people might read portions of this book and find justification for doing very destructive and evil things. And that fills me with remorse.
Well, you used the word earlier, denial. that's very much what this film is about. At the same time, Bill genuinely doesn't seem to know the full legacy of his book, and he's willfully, it seems, ignored a lot of the news that may have forced him to confront that. Did you really have a sense that you would be completely shattering his worldview? I mean, you are cracking this bubble that he had created that had allowed him to ignore that legacy over all these years.
I was amazed that he hadn't spent more time examining it. I mean, I suppose, and in the days of, you know, the internet, that it being so easy to Google yourself and to Google the book and learn about this, and here he had made some public statements, I would have thought that he would have done more to learn the extent of, you know, how the book has been used and connected with some of these other episodes. I, of course, recognized how painful it would be to do that. Mm-hmm. And so as I learned and heard Bill describe the kind of avoidance that he had gone through, or denial, as you say, I wasn't surprised by that. And I was moved by it, because it seemed to me a very natural response. I mean, most of us, I think, don't dwell on the painful chapters of our past. And some of us go as far as trying to sort of edit out the elements of our past, the stories from our past that we're not proud of. So it struck me as a very human and natural response. And I suppose I thought other people could learn from that, empathize with it, and that would make it a compelling story to tell.
Mm-hmm. Really, the key image of the film for me, it's more of a recurring key gesture, and it's Bill's head nod, which is usually quite assertive. It's as if he's physically trying to convince you, in this case, you, the Inquisitor, us, maybe the audience, maybe even himself, that he means exactly what he's saying, when in reality, he is perhaps being disingenuous. And I hate to even use that word, much less suggest that he's lying, because that might paint him in a way that doesn't really do justice to the complexity of what you're urging him to confront. But it's there in one of his opening answers when he says the book wasn't a call to action. We get the nod when he describes a prank. What is it, against a headmaster back in school? And he talks about the car going into a ditch gracefully. We get that nod. And as we get deeper into the movie, they change. Those gestures change seemingly in line with his perspective changing or shifting a little bit. Those nods, for me anyway, were almost like a poker tell, betraying something that he's hiding, that he may not even be fully aware of that he's hiding. Did you see them in that way?
Absolutely. I really appreciate that you mentioned that. I mean, as I say, Errol Morris is one of the filmmakers who I think has so beautifully explored how people speak and how they communicate by just the simplicity of an interview and finding a good subject and asking them to speak openly and freely about a subject, about themselves. And I find his choice of subjects often fascinating, and I hope that people find him to be as compelling a character. And I think that is one of his tells, or it certainly is a signifier of Bill's need or his desire to tell the story and resolve doubt, to be resigned, I guess, mm-hmm. that he's told the complete story. And Bill, you know, Bill is a very smart man and himself a writer. And I think it is kind of an attempt on his part to write the story in such a way that he is able to put a period at the end of the sentence and move on. I mean, that's why I kept some of those gestures in the film as I was editing it.
In terms of how you communicate with Bill, you start out very plainly inquisitive. And I would say that the tone never becomes, on your part, aggressive or argumentative. And yet it is prodding. You don't just accept his answers. And in that way, I suppose it could be described as confrontational. You are asking him to confront decisions he's made or certain decisions he didn't make. What's that like for you being in that position? I'm not fully aware of your background. I don't know if you have a journalism background where you're used to asking those kind of really hard questions after you've presumably developed a relationship with someone. But I don't recall it being a muscle you had to stretch with your last film, Finding Vivian Maier.
Well, I'm a former lawyer.
Okay.
And so that may be part of it. I mean, I guess I am still a lawyer, but I'm not a practicing lawyer. And so I think there was an element of the interview process that I knew would be I guess, confrontational, for lack of a better word, where Bill would be resistant to examining some of the tougher questions, the tougher elements of the story, the fact that he continued to receive money, the fact that he could have published the book under a pseudonym but chose not to, chose to have it be under his name, kept his name on the book, et cetera, when he had opportunities to potentially do something about the publication and stop it from being published. To the extent that he had any power to do that, he just chose not to exercise it and chose to be paid instead. Those sorts of things I knew would be difficult, and so I didn't relish those parts of the interview. They were hard on Bill, certainly, and harder for him than for me. But there were parts of the interview where that were more confrontational than they needed to be, or than I expected them to be, I guess I should say. For example, just the very beginning of the film, where I asked Bill about the book and the fact that it advocates violence, and he denies that. Mm-hmm. That really surprised me. I mean, there were moments where Bill seemed to be trying to kind of carve out positions that I thought he had already given up, I guess, for lack of a better word. Like, he had already made public statements regretting the fact that the book advocates violence. So I was very surprised to see him resisting that.
The book, as I read it, advocates the violent overthrow of the American government.
I was very fed up with the government. But it wasn't a call to action. There's no call to action in the book itself.
How often do you read the book?
I haven't read it since I wrote it. I don't have a copy of it.
Yeah, I mean, there were moments in the interview where it felt like a chess match, and I can't say that I was enjoying that experience at the time, because Bill had graciously agreed to the interview, and I didn't think it would be all just a cakewalk for both of us, because I knew there would be hard questions to have to answer, but I certainly didn't want to offend him, and I wanted to make sure that the story that I was telling was fair and truthful and reflected who he was and how he, you know, how he feels about it now as the film is progressing.
Mm-hmm. In terms of thinking about the way the film is structured, I think it very much could be argued that it's structured around those stages of denial that maybe he undergoes throughout this process of this examination with you. Early on, as you said, he's denying that it's even a call to action to violence. He says very blatantly, as the disclaimer says right there, it's not for kids or morons. He's basically saying, why are you trying to pin this on me? And then midway through, it's, I suppose I can see people reading this and being influenced by it. And then by the end, he is much more resigned to accepting that it was more blatant than that, and seeing some kind of personal blame, I suppose. That does seem to be fair to say, in seeing how he processes this whole thing. The other part of that was just my experience as a viewer, narratively, not knowing about the full legacy of this book, being aware of it and being aware that it had some involvement in some of these infamous acts of terror, but not really getting it sort of the way Bill Powell doesn't seem to get it. I started out being someone just kind of fascinated by him as a detached figure, thinking of him as someone that I couldn't really relate to. And then the movie shifts at some point. And when we start to get that laundry list, as he calls it, and you confront him with the legacy of this book, then it does start to become a case where there's something more horrifying and profound about it. I started to see him as someone who really is haunted by this companion, this constant companion, as he calls it later in the film. And I started thinking about how I would live with that knowledge. How did you approach the way you structured all this material after you had shot it?
I think that I would not have been interested in telling Bill's story if I didn't feel that he was a decent and kind human being. I am interested in telling stories about, you know, people who we can relate to and whose stories we can learn from. And that was true in the case of finding Vivian Meyer, and it's true in Bill's case. And I don't know if Bill was in complete denial about his feelings of responsibility, if Bill refused to acknowledge that he felt any sense of remorse, well, then that would make him a monster. And I wouldn't be interested in telling his story.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the real struggle, I think, that the film is hoping to examine is was Bill ever able to reconcile and integrate the book into his life story? You know, he says at the beginning of the film that he feels remorse about the book being connected with acts of violence, but he doesn't regret having written the book. He sort of draws this fine distinction between remorse and regret. And I ask him what he means by that. What is the distinction? He says, well, maybe I'm just playing with words.
Uh-huh.
But I think there was a distinction in Bill's mind. And I think it's that Bill he wasn't able to write the book out of his life story. He wasn't able to edit it out of his life story. It was a part of his life story. It did take a toll on him, but it also made him who he was. Bill became a teacher of kids with special needs, kids with ADD and ADHD and, you know, emotional and learning needs. And he did that because I think he related to them. He saw, he says, a bit of himself in them. And I think the book played a role in that. I think he says, you know, it's kind of ironic that he ended up working with kids, the kinds of kids who have turned to that book in the case of school shooters. I mean, alienated kids, kids right. who are angry. And I think Bill was very much that young man, and he made something of himself after having written this book. And you could say that without the book, he would not have become the educator that he was. He wouldn't have been the empathetic teacher that I think he became. And so in that sense, I think he wants to say on some level he doesn't regret the book because it made him the person that he is, both, you know, for better and for worse.
Right. Were you able to get a sense of how he reacted to the film? I learned after seeing the movie that he just passed away quite recently.
Unfortunately, he did pass away before the film came out. He passed away before the film was finished. And it was about a year after we did the filming, so he was not able to see it. Sadly, he didn't get a chance to see the film or talk about it. I think part of me wishes that Bill would have been able to speak about the film, speak about the book and his past, and I think he would have had a lot to offer young people and audiences to talk about his story and you know, the things that he, as an educator, has learned about violence, about anger in young people, boys in particular, and alienation. And I think he could have even done more to distance himself from the book after the film came out.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish he would have had that opportunity.
Here on Film Spotting, we do top five lists. And I was thinking about our listeners who maybe are a little bit intimidated by documentary film. They don't know where to start, or they're just new to documentaries and could use a little bit of guidance. I asked you to submit your top five most influential documentaries. And I don't know, Charlie, maybe the next time you're in Chicago, we need to get together and go bowling or something, because we've got a lot in common. We'll start with the three that we actually have right in common, directly in line: High School, Frederick Wiseman; The Thin Blue Line, Errol Morris, who you've talked about a lot; and Salesman, Albert and David Maisels and Charlotte Zwerin. I actually had, at the time in 2011, I had Grey Gardens on the list, but I hadn't seen Salesman yet. I have come to love that film and appreciate it as my favorite Maisels film. So what was it about those three films that stood out to you?
Well, Salesman in particular, I'll just say, is to me the perfectly constructed verite documentary. It's what I think documentary, for me personally, does when it's at its best, which is it takes, you know, real life events and, in the hands of a talented filmmaker, allows it to play out with all of the elements of story construction and the rules of drama to, you know, a satisfying end. It starts with a wonderful premise and plays out to an incredible conclusion. I mean, Salesman is about a group of traveling salesmen in the South and they're Bible salesmen.
Yeah.
And I think if you took that premise and tried to write it as a novel, you would basically write the story that unfolds in the Maisels film Salesman, with all of the themes of religion and capitalism and the crisis of faith that a salesman might have when he goes door to door selling the Bible to people who maybe can't afford it. and the faith in his own ability as an aging salesman that, you know, that play out in stories like Death of a Salesman and in Glengarry Glen Ross.
Mm-hmm.
But also his own kind of religious crisis of faith with that added.
Well, everything in this life is a sacrifice.
Oh, that's for sure.
Right? How about 6 months from now?
Who knows what 6 months is going to bring?
Well, nobody knows what the next day is going to come. You know,
that's why I don't want to take the chance and commit myself.
Well, it wouldn't be too much of a chance. It involves $49.95 for the Bible, Mrs. O'Connor. And that's not much, you know what I mean? A carton of cigarettes a week costs you $3. Does Dad have a birthday coming up?
I guess what I particularly appreciate about it is that it feels like there is a very strong hand of a filmmaker who is a storyteller, which is sort of ironic because Albert Maysles over the years has said a lot of things. He passed away not too long ago, but he would go to great pains to say about verite filmmaking, his filmmaking in particular, and how he is sort of the opposite of, say, a Michael Moore, who is my mentor in filmmaking. And I, for all of my respect for Albert Maysles, the Maysles brothers, and the work they do, I feel that it does a discredit to what they do to suggest that they are somehow passively observing and objectively observing events as they unfold and then just allowing an audience to see. I think it's disingenuous and it's a discredit to the craft in that film and in general. In the best verite filmmaking is brilliant editing, but also brilliant storytelling instincts, starting with the choice of subject and obviously following through to where you point the camera and who you choose as the interesting subject to feature and focus on, and how you shoot scenes, and then, of course, how you observe them and where you decide to follow the story. So I am a fan of documentaries that satisfy the storytelling demands, I guess, and ambitions of great literature. You mentioned Thin Blue Line. I mean, that has obviously a social justice aspect to it. It's a brilliant film that actually helped get someone who was on death row exonerated. So what greater thing could a film accomplish than that? And so obviously I recognize there's a whole social justice aim and ambition of many great documentary films, and it's hard to argue with that as the greatest accomplishment a film can have. But for example, in Michael Moore's Roger and Me, which is also on my list of my favorites, way up there, I think Michael is brilliant because he combines the two. He combines a social message and a desire to say something about the world and change the world, and with all of the gifts of a great storyteller, including a great sense of humor and using humor in situations where very few other people would think to inject it. And, you know, Michael has this incredible ability to combine great pathos with humor. And he shows that in Roger and Me, which is, you know, obviously about the economic decline of Flint, Michigan, and job losses and auto plant closings and economic despair, with great visual and song choice and subject matter and choices in subject matter that are just really funny.
Some disturbing news today from the Genesee County Health Department. It announced the rat population in Flint has now surpassed the human population by 50,000. Health officials say that's due to the massive numbers of people leaving Flint and the city cutting back to twice monthly garbage collection due to budget constraints.
But really, for me, there is nothing like Salesman in terms of just of doing the two things that I think are hardest to combine, which is verite filmmaking, just taking the raw stuff of life and constructing it into a novel-like story experience, you know, novelistic storytelling.
I'm so glad you made that point, because it's certainly true of High School with Wiseman and Salesman that they are far more subtly crafted than something like The Thin Blue Line, where Errol Morris is a constant presence and character even in a way in that film. But to suggest they're not crafted would be misguided. They are obviously very, very finely crafted, and all those elements that you spoke to come through. You did have Roger and me on your list, as you said. I had another, I suppose, social justice activist doc about the disenfranchised fighting back against a corporation. It was Barbara Koppel's Harlan County, USA. And we also had another similar choice. You went with Marwin Call, the 2010 documentary by Jeff Malmberg. I had James Marsh's Man on Wire from 2008, my favorite film of that year. Both films, I suppose, in a way, about unconventional artists.
Yeah, Man on Wire would have probably been number six for me, so it was up there. Marwin Call, I think, what I particularly like about that film is, again, the choice. I really appreciate the strong hand of a filmmaker who makes choices about how to construct the story. And Jeff does a really, I mean, I think that film is so carefully crafted and constructed that I think he reveals information about the character at just the right moments. And there's nothing about the story that tells you, there's nothing about the person's story, the facts of the character, the facts of their life that tell you how to reveal to your audience those facts. And so to me, as a filmmaker, you have to make choices about that. And so the question is, well, what is the story that you're trying to tell? And so how do you reveal information when? And I just remember watching that film and feeling like I was in the hands of a very gifted filmmaker who knew just when to tell me what about the character in order to have the experience, again, like I was reading a novel.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's what I guess I really appreciate that when I'm watching films. And I think I even felt that way in just in terms of the storytelling techniques in Thin Blue Line, just because first I had never seen anything like that before, and it was so revolutionary. And again, I think that Errol Morris in that film, with he is a stronger presence, as you say, than these other Verite films. But he feels like a narrator who is kind of a character in the film and pushing things along, mm-hmm. which really works in that film.
Yeah, Charlie, thank you so much for your time. Best of luck with the film.
Oh, it's such a pleasure, and we'll figure out a day to go bowling.
There you go. I'm looking forward to it. We'll talk docs. Thanks.
All right. Thanks. Sounds good.
When was the first time you learned a connection between an act of violence and the book?
It was Columbine.
I had no idea. Why would I make the connection?
You had written a book about it, an instructional book.
I'm getting the impression that you want me to say something I'm not saying.
Do you feel responsible?
If you're asking, do I wish I had done more? Yes.
My thanks again to Charlie Siskel for that conversation and that top five. Josh, you have not seen the movie American Anarchist yet, and you're not generally as into documentaries as I am. I think that's fair to say, even though you are a fan of the art form generally. I don't know, though, if you can come along on our bowling trip. Sorry.
Come on. I'm really good at bowling. Does
are
that
you?
Count?
Well, that no, makes me want to leave you okay. out even more. I mean, I want to win. So
we remember the family bowling trip we took?
I do.
Yes, a double day with the entire families. I don't remember how I performed that night.
No, I don't either. I think maybe we need to have another outing. We can tune up for our bout with Charlie Siskel.
With Charlie Siskel, absolutely.
Yeah. American Anarchist is currently playing in limited release. It's available to rent on demand on iTunes and elsewhere. If you see the film, love to hear what you thought. Our email, as always, feedback@filmspotting.net. And that's our show. At filmspotting.net is where you can find 12 years of reviews, interviews, and top fives in the show archives. While you're there, we hope you'll vote in the latest Film Spotting poll. And if you haven't already, check out the Film Spotting family of podcasts, The Next Picture Show and Film Spotting SVU. You can find both in iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Out in limited release, a woman, Anne Hathaway, discovers that severe catastrophic events are somehow connected to the mental breakdown from which she's suffering. Sounds intriguing. Queen of the Desert, one of a pair of Werner Herzog movies getting uncharacteristically hammered so far by critics. This one stars Nicole Kidman. After the Storm, the latest from Japanese auteur Hirokazu Koreeda, and Their Finest, a British film crew attempts to boost morale during World War II by making a propaganda film. It's directed by Lona Scherfig, who did An Education. It stars Bill Nighy and Gemma Arterton, and as we said, American Anarchist out as well. We'll link to more information about how you can see American Anarchist where it's playing in our show notes. Out in wide release, The Fate of the Furious, a.k.a. Furious 8. And Josh, as we sit here right now, I have already taped my review of that. Having just come from the screening, Genevieve Kosky, Tasha Robinson from the Next Picture Show were nice enough to join me. And we had almost as much fun as they probably did making the movie, I think.
Well, I could detect the excitement in your voice. You're just on a high, like a speed high from watching it, aren't you?
Yeah, that's what happens with these movies. So
it is.
Yeah. Hey, and then
we're going to go see it on opening day, Debbie and I, in the morning. You know, she got hooked when we did our Fast and Furious mini marathon. Yep. So she wants to line up and see that Friday. So
yeah, that's
we'll
great.
Check it out.
I can't wait to hear what you thought of it. If you have thoughts on the Fast and Furious movies or anything else movie related, you can leave us a short voicemail and we may use it in next week's show. 312-264-0744.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Hogren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.